This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Here we enlighten you with ayahs 36 through 38 from the Surah Nahl, recited by Qasim Razi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Wa laqad ba'athna fi kulli ummatin rasulan an i'budullaha wa jtanibut taghut. فَمِنْهُمْ مَنْ هَدَى اللَّهُ وَمِنْهُمْ مَنْ حَقَّتْ عَلَيْهِ الضَّلَالَةِ فَسِيرُوا فِي الْأَرْضِ فَانْظُرُوا كَيْفَ كَانَ على هداهم فإن الله لا يهدي من يضل وما لهم من ناصرين وأقسموا ولكن أكثر الناس لا يعلمون بلى وعدا عليه حقا ولكن أكثر الناس لا يعلمون صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most gracious, the most compassionate. And certainly we raised in every nation an apostle, saying, serve Allah and shun the Satan. So there were some of them who Allah guided, and there were others against whom error was due. Therefore travel in the land, then see what was the end of the rejecters. If you desire further guidance, yet surely Allah does not guide him who leads astray, nor shall they have any helpers. And they swear by Allah with the most energetic of their oath, Allah will not raise up him who dies. Yeah, is a promise binding on him, quite true, but most people do not know.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The Gaza Strip witnesses more death and destruction as the Israeli regime presses ahead with its genocidal war across their territories. Israeli media say a suspected Yemeni missile has targeted the occupied territories a day after the regime's attacks on Sana'a and Jaf, with 35 people dead. Qatar calls for the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to be brought to justice over the regime's airstrikes on Doha to assassinate the leaders of Hamas. Hello and welcome everybody here in the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is World News. Our top story, the Gaza Strip witnesses more death and destruction as the Israeli regime presses ahead with its genocidal war across their territory. The regime's latest attacks remain focused on Gaza City, killing nearly a dozen civilians in the western parts of the city, including in the Al-Shati refugee camp. Palestinian sources also reported 17 deaths and dozens of injuries after the bombing of displaced people's tents in western Gaza. Four more Palestinians were killed in an airstrike on a gathering of citizens south of the Al-Nusayrat camp in central Gaza. Five more civilians also died of famine and malnutrition on Wednesday, raising the total toll to more than 400, including 141 children. The death toll from the Israeli genocide is near 64,660, with more than 163,500 others injured. Tunisian officials have for the first time confirmed that a ship from the Gaza-bound Global Samoud flotilla has been hit by a premeditated aggression. This after the flotilla's organizers said late Tuesday that another of their boats had been struck in a suspected drone attack off Tunisia's coast, that being the second in 24 hours. Tunisia's interior ministry said it was launching an investigation into the incident and marked the first acknowledgement by Tunisian authorities of the attack, after the National Guard had earlier denied the presence of any drones. The British-flagged Alma was attacked off the Tunisian coast, sustaining fire damage to its top deck. The incident came a day after the flotilla reported another of its boats was hit by a similar suspected drone strike. Despite the attacks, activists aboard the boats reaffirmed their commitment to continue the peaceful voyage. The Global Samoud flotilla had departed Barcelona late last month with about 20 ships.
The Global Samoud flotilla continues its course towards Gaza. After some technical stops, the boats have entered African waters, where more vessels are preparing to join the fleet. On the boats, volunteer participants say that they came here because governments and the big international institutions have rejected the resounding calls from every corner of the globe to take action against genocide.
Every single person, with exception, that I've spoken to recognizes the horrific reality on the ground in Gaza, and we simply represent what the people wish. The reality is the government's actions do not represent the people. We've seen that time and time again, and it's unfortunately led to the point where civil society is now left no other option but to undertake personal risk of this nature, where mothers, daughters, fathers, wives, husbands are on these long voyages of almost 2,000 miles across the sea in rough conditions, putting ourselves at risk.
After unsuccessful attempts to deliver food and aid by land, volunteers say expanding the flotilla and building on past solidarity missions is their best shot at getting the supplies into Gaza.
We have to deliver this humanitarian aid through international water because it is the only option left available to us. Keir Starmer said just a few days ago that he would not protect the flotilla because the only sustainable means of delivering aid to Gaza is via land. That's proven not to work. The only sustainable method is through sea, through international waters, under the protection of international law. And realistically, our governments, the UN, they should all be taking this method. But as they haven't, it's down to us, down to civil society, to step up with our skills and our will.
The flotilla has already been targeted by two drone attacks in 2 days in an attempt to deter the mission. Global Summit Flotilla organizers say that intimidation will not derail participants in their determination to complete the mission.
It's making it very clear that we have chosen the right path, that what we are doing today is the best option to stand in solidarity with the Palestinian people. The nature of Israel, a criminal government that is willing to commit crimes everywhere, simply to stop solidarity, to stop a civilian movement that is bringing humanitarian aid. So we are sailing.
As ships arrive in Tunisia, preparations begin for the journey to come, which will be the longer phase of the mission. It will begin at the port of Tunis with the intention of reaching the shores of Gaza. Camila Escalante, The Mediterranean.
Sirens sound in several areas of the Israeli-occupied Palestinian territories after a suspected Yemeni missile attack. According to the Israeli media, the alerts were heard in the Al-Naqab Desert and Wadi Araba in the south, as well as in parts of the north. The Israeli army claims it intercepted the ballistic missile. The strike comes following Israeli air raids on Yemen, it was carried out on Wednesday. In that attack, regime warplanes targeted the capital Sana'a and the Al-Jawf province. The strikes killed 35 people and left more than 130 others injured. Yemeni officials have slammed Israeli aggression, vowing a strong response. The Israeli regime has launched a new airstrike on southern Lebanon in violation of a ceasefire agreement with the Arab country. The attack targeted a motorcycle on a road near the city of Tyre, leaving one person dead. Tel Aviv used a drone in this strike. The identity of the victim has not yet been released. The latest aggression blatantly violates the November truce agreement reached after the 66-day war. The Lebanese government has time and again slammed the Tel Aviv regime for undermining the country's sovereignty, but has stopped short of taking practical steps. Qatar's prime minister has called for the Israeli prime minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, to be brought to justice after the regime conducted airstrikes on Doha to assassinate the leaders of Hamas. In an interview with CNN, Sheikh Mohammed bin Abdulrahman Al Thani also warned that Netanyahu's actions and the unprecedented strike on Hamas's leaders have killed any hope for the regime's captives in Gaza. Sheikh Mohammed added, the Doha is reassessing everything related to its involvement in future ceasefire talks for Gaza. On Tuesday, Israel struck Hamas leaders in Qatar as they were discussing a U.S.-proposed ceasefire plan for Gaza. Hamas later confirmed six fatalities, but said its senior members had survived, calling the strike a failed assassination attempt. Qatar has hosted Hamas's political bureau since 2012 and has been a key mediator in the Gaza peace efforts alongside Egypt and the United States. Just moments ago, we had news of sirens sounding in several areas of the Israeli-occupied Palestinian territories after a suspected Yemeni missile attack. Yusuf Maori is joining us now from the Yemeni capital, Sana'a, to bring us up to speed on all the latest information that he may have with regards to this anti-Israeli operation. Yusuf.
Yes, this is one of many more to come missile attacks against the Israeli regime, as has been promised by Yemen's armed forces spokesperson Yahya Sari', as has been promised by various Yemeni officials. Israel will sustain heavy damage and will suffer great consequences for the atrocities and the crimes that it's committing against the Palestinian people and also, of course, against Yemeni civilians, obviously referring to the latest attack by Israel targeting various government facilities, government buildings, and also targeting residential neighborhoods here in the capital, Sana'a, where 37 have been killed. 37 have been killed in this latest attack by Israel. It's been condemned by various nations, by various groups across the world. But the message that's being sent from Yemeni officials is that retaliation will be severe. The message being sent from the Yemeni people is a call upon Yemen's armed forces to continue striking Israel no matter the consequences, no matter how much Yemenis suffer under these brutal Israeli attacks. The Yemeni people are urging their armed forces, their army, to continue the attacks and to not only attack Israel from air, but to also attack Israel from land and and from sea, from land referring to other parts of the Middle East, to attack Israeli military sites wherever they can, even Israeli military sites or intelligence buildings cooperating with Israel in some of the Arab nations, in countries in the Persian Gulf, wherever there is any ally of Israel. Yemenis want their army to hold that nation accountable, whether it's Saudi Arabia, the UAE, Jordan, or even Egypt. Anyone who's associating with Israel in the killing of Yemenis, they want them to be held accountable, and they want the Yemeni army to take also military actions against them, and at the very least, impose naval blockades on nations like Saudi Arabia, the UAE, Jordan, and Egypt for their cooperation and what some assume or even accuse them of coordinating these attacks with Israel against Yemen.
All right, thanks, Saad. Yusuf Mowry joining us from the Yemeni capital, Sana'a. Well, going back to our previous story, geopolitical analyst Ryan Dawson joined us earlier. He said if Israel was truly trying to free its captives, it could trade them for Palestinian abductees as it did once back in 2023.
If Israel was serious about getting hostages from Hamas, they could do that the same way they did that in 2023 with a hostage exchange. Hamas has already accepted umpteen deals. If they were serious about it, they could simply trade Palestinian prisoners for the Israeli prisoners and be done. They're using the hostage crisis as an excuse to continue ethnic cleansing and starving a population of 2 million people. And now they're violating the airspace of Qatar, who, on good faith, was trying to broker a ceasefire. And I wouldn't doubt it if the U.S. had their dirty hands all over this. You saw this with the war in June. They said they would meet with Iran and will finish talking on Sunday, and then Israel attacked on Friday. And then under the guise of a ceasefire, let's meet, and then that the U.S. arranged, and they agreed to, Israel preemptively attacks and tries to murder everybody. There is no hope for peace. There never was, because Israel doesn't want peace. That isn't really their goal. You can't really, in good faith and honesty, negotiate with psychopaths. They want to ethnically cleanse Gaza. October 7th was their pretext. They could easily get their hostages out with a hostage exchange. They're not a serious partner in this. And so it really doesn't matter if Qatar pulls out or not, because the Israelis have already decided that peace isn't what they're aiming for. They're aiming for further ethnic cleansing.
Iran's president has once again condemned Israel's aggression against Qatar, urging a unified and powerful stance by Muslim countries to prevent further inhumane moves by the regime. In a phone conversation with his Egyptian counterpart, Masoud Pezeshkian stressed that Israel's actions prove the regime's disregard for all international norms and its readiness to attack any country at will. Pezeshkian expressed hope that all Muslim nations would act as a united front to prevent any future aggression by the Israeli regime against Islamic countries. For his part, Abdel Fattah al-Sisi strongly condemned Israel's attack on Qatar, reaffirming Egypt's opposition to any encroachment on Muslim countries. He emphasized that the recent acts of aggression by Israel highlight the urgent need for a coordinated and resolute response to its expansionist ambitions. Hezbollah Secretary General Sheikh Naim Qassem has deemed the Israeli strike on Hamas leaders in Qatar as a perilous escalation.
I believe that the attack on Qatar is one of the steps of the greater Israel from the Euphrates to the Nile. What is delaying the project and what's driving them mad is the continuance of their resistance, and the resistance not surrendering and not bowing in submission in Palestine, Lebanon, and the region.
Sheikh Qassem praised Palestinian resistance, referring to the recent operation near occupied Al-Quds as bold and courageous. On the domestic front, Sheikh Qassem urged all Lebanese citizens to unite, proclaiming that the ongoing resistance represents a historic milestone and a source of strength. He emphasizes stopping Israel's offensive, ensuring its withdrawal, and facilitating reconstruction are Lebanon's foremost priorities. He pledged that the resistance will not forsake Lebanon, even if the world stands united against it. Rallies have been held across Pakistan to condemn Israeli airstrikes on Qatar. Pakistan has also officially denounced the attack, warning that the Israeli aggression poses a serious threat to regional peace and stability. Our correspondent Nasser Kazmi has more in this report from Islamabad.
Anti-US and anti-Israel rallies were held across Pakistan to condemn Israel's latest airstrikes targeting the headquarters of the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas in Qatar. Religious scholars, political workers, and civil society activists attended the demonstrations in Pakistan's major cities and towns, calling on the international community to help end the Israeli genocidal war on Gaza and bring peace to the West Asian region.
The attitude of the Israel is not very much serious in order to ceasefire the war between Israel and the Palestine. We think that the main superpowers of the globe superpowers, they are actually supporting the Israel behind. And apparently they are doing the verbal communication in the form of condemning the Israeli attack on Palestinian and the Gaza people.
The demonstrators denounced the international community's silence in the face of Israel's war crimes in the region.
People everywhere are calling it aloud. Israel and the United States are working hand in hand, repeatedly attacking sovereign nations. The assault on Qatar proves that Israel, emboldened by the U.S. backing, now feels free to strike any country it chooses, ignoring international rules with complete impunity.
Protesters also offered funeral prayers in absentia for the officials who were assassinated by Israel, seeking peace and justice for the people of occupied Palestine.
In Qatar, Israel sabotaged all diplomatic rules and regulations by striking the Palestinian and Hamas leadership, assassinating several people. This attack is nothing less than a strong slap on the face of Arab rulers who are busy in appeasing the U.S. and the Israeli regime.
Meanwhile, Pakistan's Prime Minister Shehbaz Sharif strongly denounced the Israeli airstrikes on Doha. He warned that this provocation not only violates Qatar's sovereignty, but also threatens to destabilize the entire region.
Protesters in Pakistan are raising their voices against Israel's attack on Qatar. But without firm international action, the region is likely to remain on edge amid ongoing Israeli strikes against countries in the region. Nasser Kazmi, Islamabad.
And that is a wrap for Islamabad's News Bulletin. Thank you so much for staying with us.
The similarities between us. Take a minute and see yourself in the mirror. You look like me, those eyes, lips, you can't deny. Have you thought about why we look the same, why we feel the same? Don't tell me it's by chance. Oh, I'm not afraid to die. wish you could realize there's no difference between us two. We're part of one family, no matter how far you are. And even if we don't know each other, oh, you and me, me and you, we are one. Oh, you're my brother, you're my sister.
Al-Naqi means the pure, the immaculate, the clean. Al-Hadi means the guide. All the Imams came for guidance.
As-salamu alaykum ya ahla bayt al-nubuwa wa mawdi'a al-risala wa mukhtalaf al-malaw.
Peace be upon the directors of right guidance, the lanterns in darkness, the patterns of piety.
This is Dialogue, an introduction into the most important dialogues and conversations of Imam Ali ibn Muhammad al-Hadi alayhi salam. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Imam Ali ibn Muhammad al-Hadi alayhi salam was a pure source of wisdom and knowledge. Despite his young age, he showed what divinely gifted knowledge really looks like. Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam was the direct descendant of the Messenger of Allah, peace and blessings upon him and his holy household. Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam was also the 10th divinely appointed Imam, and he was the 10th divinely appointed successor of the Messenger of Allah, peace and blessings upon him. Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam was also the son of the 9th divinely appointed Imam, Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Jawad alayhi salam. After Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam answered with the answers of an expert the most difficult of questions posed to him by the Shia scholars and jurisprudents, the Shia leaders at that time had more faith and certainty now of what they had previously believed, that a divinely appointed Imam must have the most knowledge and he must be the most knowledgeable one of his time, regardless of whether he is young or old. And so the knowledge, virtue, and the delving into the sciences of the Holy Quran and the Sunnah of Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam astonished the minds and sparked meetings and gatherings in all parts of the Muslim world.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. It's an honor to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. So we're talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam. There's a very beautiful dialogue from His Eminence, the 10th divinely appointed Imam. One of his companions, he was talking about the world and he was talking about how his life was difficult. And it just seemed like that life was so challenging and trying, and there were so many difficulties that he was facing in his life. And so he spoke about these things with Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam, and after listening to this companion's misfortunes and trials and tribulations and difficulties, Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam said some very beautiful words of advice and kind of to give strength and encouragement to this companion of his. Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam, well, before I continue and say what he said, this statement that Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam said is something that is applicable to our lives in this present day. We realize that we also face challenges, we face difficulties, we face trials, we face a lot of problems in our life in this world. And so this statement that I will relate from Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam is a statement that can help every single one of us. Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam says that Allah made the world and the life of the world a place of trial and trying, and Allah has made the afterlife a place of reward. Allah has made the misfortunes of the worldly life as a means for the reward of the afterlife, and Allah has made the reward of the afterlife as a compensation for the misfortunes of the worldly life. Something that applies and can help every single one of us all across the world. This world and the life of this world is a place of trial and difficulty and trying. But Allah, alhamdulillah, praise and blessings be to Him, has made the afterlife a place of reward. And the misfortunes that come about in our life, that we are able to overcome and be steadfast and patient upon, lead to reward in the afterlife. And the reward of the afterlife is a compensation for all of the things that might happen to us in this worldly life. So we look forward to that which awaits every single one of us. This is Dialogue, Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam. At this moment, we invite you to listen to parts of the Arabic text of Ziyarat Jamiatul Kabira by Imam Hadi alayhi salam, along with its English translation. Please stay tuned.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu ala a'immatil huda wa masabih at-tuja wa a'lam at-tuqa wa dawin.
In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Peace be upon the directors of right guidance, the lanterns in darkness, the patterns of piety, the owners of understanding, the endued with thought, the havens of the peoples, the inheritors of the prophets, the perfect specimen, the most excellent call, and the arguments of Allah against the inhabitants of the world, the hereafter and the former world. Allah's mercy and blessings too be upon you all.
Wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. As-salamu ala mahal.
Peace be upon the exponents of the recognition of Allah, the centers of Allah's blessing, the essence of Allah's wisdom, the keepers of Allah's secrets, the bearers of Allah's book, the successor of Allah's Prophet, and the progeny of Allah's Messenger. May Allah send blessings upon him and his household. Allah's mercy and blessings too be upon them.
Wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. As-salamu ala al-a'immat al-du'at.
Peace be upon the Imams, the leaders, the guides, the chiefs, the authorities, the defenders, the protectors, the people of the reminder, the men in authority, the left ones by Allah, His select, His party,
the case of his knowledge, his argument, his path, his light, his proof. Allah's mercy and blessings to be upon them.
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.ir/en Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many other great programs as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
There are scholars who delve into the complexities of geopolitics and international relations, examining the forces that shape global dynamics. Their work often bridges theoretical frameworks and practical implications, bringing insights into the interplay of security, economics, and diplomacy. Among them are those who focus on Eurasian integration and the evolving role of conservatism in global politics. My guest today exemplifies this dedication, contributing to academic discourse and shaping perspectives on international affairs. I am Bahman Nouray, your host. Welcome to SOAP.
Glenn Deaton is a Norwegian political scientist and author born in 1979. He specializes in international relations, geopolitics, geoeconomics, and Russian foreign policy. His academic work often explores the interplay between security institutions, conservatism, and Eurasian integration. Deaton has also contributed to journals like Russia in Global Affairs and authored several books on geopolitics and international relations.
Mr. Glenn Deaton, it's a pleasure to have you here on SOAP.
Oh, thank you. It's my pleasure.
I want to talk about, you did a dissertation on EU and NATO relations with Russia. I want to see, of course, nowadays everybody's speaking of forming a new military force in Europe because of the 2% argument for the US and everything. How do you think, how feasible do you think that idea is?
2%? Well, it would have been more feasible before. Now Europe is in a deep economic crisis. Now, on principle, I would think it's a good idea, but it depends. It depends to what's end. To what end? Yeah. If Europe spends military and becomes more self-sufficient, America, then I think it's going to be a positive thing, because when you have huge security dependence on the United States, it will use the security dependence to extract political concessions, economic loyalty, and this is why the Europeans often do things which are against their own interest. So if we arm ourselves and push and say, you know, make the Americans you know, step aside or, you know, go home, then I think this could be positive, because then at least we would use our military to enhance our own national interest. But I don't see this happening. I think it's we're just going to add this to the United States arsenal and look for more military solutions. And from my perspective, that would be, yeah, the worst we can do now, because this was the curse of the unipolar moment. You know, usually the point of departure in security strategy is you want to mitigate or reduce security competition. You can't just have two countries, more weapon is more security. No, you have to reduce the security concerns of your opponents as well. This is usually what security strategies are about. Instead, hegemonic international order, you're so overwhelmingly dominant that no one can, you know, it doesn't matter if they're fearful, they can't do anything anyways. This is the hegemonic order. We have to move away from this. This is why when we have conflicts with the Russians, the first impulse is, well, how can we defeat them? But as I said before, the solution, you know, first you pick up the phone to find out if it's necessary to fight this war. And we haven't done this.
Exactly. Thinking about the European pattern, how possible do you think there would be for the Middle East to have the same sort of regional kind of togetherness and unity from a perspective of international relations, sort of convergence?
Well, it should be possible. I mean, we often see, for example, the Gulf states and Iran have tensions, but if you see the things that unite them versus what divides, it's there shouldn't be these tensions to begin with. I think, again, a key curse is how do you organize the international system? And it's been kind of common sense, not anymore, the past 30 years, but it's always been common sense that peacetime alliances are a terrible thing for stability, because it perpetuates conflicts. The entire internal structure and power depends on conflicts continuing. And the problem with the hegemonic order is it's dependent on alliance systems. So look at the United States. As long as you have some tensions between Iran and the Gulf states will be dependent on the United States. Yes. They will have economic, political loyalties because of security dependence, and you can contain and weaken Iran. Now, if peace breaks out, suddenly, you know, Iran's not contained. The Gulf states will start to act more independently of the United States. So there's always this need to perpetuate tensions. And you saw this when the Chinese, because they're not going for hegemony. They wanted to do economic, you know, connectivity with Iran, but also not alienating the Gulf states. So for them, they had an incentive to improve ties. And this is what they did. They were pushing for better relations. And you saw what was the first thing that happened? I saw a former Mossad chief writing an article that, you know, oh, if the Gulf states are not going to be part of this anti-Iranian alliance, maybe we should try to make peace with Iranians too. And suddenly it looks like peace might break out. But then what is the hegemonic role of the United States? So there's always this need for conflicts and tension. And at the end of the day, I don't think it's good for the United States either. I think they're throwing away the republic in the pursuit of empire. And they're going to lose both at the end. So I think this would be a positive some solution. Just find a way of transitioning away from alliance systems, block politics, and try to move into some inclusive security architecture. Because, you know, both Iran and, for example, Saudi Arabia have a lot of grievances, but you're going to live in the same neighborhood. You're going to have to, you know, it's in your interest to find a way of living together in a good way. America's away. They don't live here. They don't have that same interest, same as in Europe. They don't have, now that the war went wrong in Ukraine, the continent is on fire, they can go home, which they are. Yeah. And so you should always prioritize your neighbors first and find some inclusive arrangements.
I want to know, of course, this is a little bit academic, but as an international relations student myself, I would really love to know your perspective on that. How do you approach the study of conservatism in the context of global politics?
Well, it's that's a big question. Well, conservatism, it often assumes that the stability of the present rests on the past.
Yeah.
So, which is why, look at China, for example. It's undergoing huge changes. With its economic rise. So when it's blowing dust powerfully around you, you need some stable anchor. And they look into their 5,000-year-old history, their traditions, customs, and culture. And this is something that creates some stability. For countries like Russia, they're also discovering conservatism as a path, because they had Russia has a very revolutionary history. They had the old Kievan Rus, they had the Moscovy, they had the European Russia under Peter the Great, Soviet Union, the failed liberalism of Yeltsin. So conservatism means you integrate all of your history into one national narrative, in which you bring the communists, the liberals, everyone's a Russian, and everyone's part of a similar narrative. And so this is becoming a new, in a more complex world under a greater change. I think this is the direction they're going. And the opposite of this is the neoliberalism, where the markets control everything and society is just an appendage. Wherever the economy goes, this is where society goes. And I think after a nice 40 years of this system, it's a natural for the world to, the pendulum swing to go the other way, for countries to not wanting to be states, they want to be states with economies, not economies with states. And I think this is the direction they're going. And to have economic integration between countries, but still being distinctive and different. Uh-huh. This is what the Chinese, by the way, say with their global civilization initiative. They're saying we don't want to be, representing universalism like the Americans with liberal democracy, where they say we're all the same and we're leading the best principles, because then you can't have sovereignty. They're saying the opposite. They're saying, each civilization should develop at their own pace and find their own path to modernity. So it's not for a Chinese to tell, for example, an Iranian how you should develop your country. So this is also conservatism.
Right.
Recognizing our distinctiveness, and that this shouldn't be a goal of globalization to eradicate distinctiveness, rather to have more connections and mutual understanding.
Right. About that, do you remember the JCPOA in 2015? Of course you do. There were supposed to be economic ties between Iran and the US and the West and everything, and I think maybe that would preserve the deal. Trump seems to be very interested in economic investment and deals. He always says, I'm the art of the deal or whatever, the book that he has. But at the same time, he was the guy who got out of JCPOA and stopped the Boeings, the Airbuses to come to Iran. That sort of economic tie, wouldn't that preserve a sort of a compelling peace in the region?
No, if you have economic incentives to preserve the peace, that's always a good thing. I think he made a big mistake, I think that's part of the struggle now, because a lot of American politics, the reason why the U.S. often acts irrational now, the definition of a rational state is one that acts in its own national interest to maximize its security. But you often see that states act irrationally when there, for example, is a power struggle within. The United States is becoming very, very polarized. So whenever he expresses his foreign policy, it's often a reflection of what's happening within. So, this was a deal. It's a bad deal. He's going to make a better deal. So you throw it out, and then you're going to negotiate something new. It's going to be very hard now, because there's no trust anymore. But on the principle of what you said, I agree. I think if you can create some economic incentives for cooperation between Iran and America, a lot of the problems could go away. So that would be positive. But then
some sort of codependence.
Yeah.
Why is it that nobody's after that? Like keeping the country out of the loop, economic loop in the world, what result will that have for the world? I want to know that, really.
Well, this is the thing. I'm not sure. That's why I'm not certain if the Americans are completely genuine when they say that they just want to solve the nuclear issue with Iran, and then we can work together. As Trump says, I want Iran to be prosperous and strong, and but just no nuclear weapons. But is that true? Because at the same time, they're saying, Iran can't have long-range ballistic missiles. They can't. They have to decouple from the resistance. So don't do anything to oppose Israel. So what they're asking for is more or less a capitulation. And if if Iran gives up its ballistic missiles, then the security will depend
no
on
deterrence,
the
right?
Yeah, they so Iran's security will depend on America's good intentions, and this is not how security works.
Yeah.
You have two sides or more. They have often reasons to have security concerns for each other. You address their mutual concerns and try to reduce it. So if you want Iran to have a less vigorous ballistic missile program, you should try to find out what is actually the concerns of Iran. So this is kind of the irony of what America is doing, because they're saying you have to have less deterrence or we'll bomb you. Now, it doesn't take a genius to explain why this is contradictory. Once you start to threaten countries, they will seek to have deterrence. So you can't threaten a country to give up its deterrent. It doesn't make any sense.
And how would they kind of expect that another country would accept such an offer?
I think it's max pressure, and that's what you're seeing now. And again, this region has, that is the Western Asia, has many different competing interests. And some have legitimate concerns about Iran. Iran has legitimate concerns about others. I think it's a key flaw in human nature that we often divide, when we look at us versus them, that we do assume that we're always the good guy, the other guy is always bad. So we assign, at least in the West, this tendency to assign the assumption of bad intentions of Iran. And we assume that they can't work with them. And it's not they're not reacting to security concerns. They're acting out of belligerence and evil, if you will.
Right.
And I think this is the main flaw, because it's not good for America either. They can actually make peace with Iran. But first you have to talk to them as an equal. That is, they have security concerns. America, I always tell people, don't hate your enemies, because all strategic thinking goes out the window. And
exactly.
I think that's very, for me at least, that's very evident in America's relations with Iran.
Yeah, exactly. Absolutely. How do you integrate neoclassical realism into your analysis of global dynamics?
Global dynamics?
Yes.
What do you mean?
I mean, if you want to come to an analysis of the current global dynamics, how would you justify that with neoclassical theory?
Well, neorealism is a theory which assumes that the international distribution of power dictates how states behave. So.
Yeah.
So the world always gravitates towards a balance of power. So, for example, in World War II, you have a big Germany, and so then there's an incentive for the Americans and Soviets to work. Once the Germans are destroyed, what are the main two powers? Well, the Soviets and America. So then, natural, they will balance each other. So this is how. So neorealism becomes a theory on the balance of power, which creates systemic incentives, which states have to act upon to maximize their security. But neorealism. It's not a foreign policy theory. It assumes also the premises that states are rational. My argument is they're not always rational. That is, between the distribution of power and foreign policy, you have an intervening variable, which is the human element. And if you have a decision maker in Washington, is he interpreting the balance of power properly and implementing the foreign policy? Likely no. He's going to have, like all other human beings, he's going to have his flaws. He's going to be lacking information. There's going to be domestic competition between different forces. There's going to be ideology, commitment to international institutions. There's a lot of reason why people not always don't act rationally. So, for example, with Europe now, a lot of the policies Europe should be pursuing, they're not, because I don't think there's much political imagination to imagine anything besides the transatlantic partnership. We lived under American protection for 80 years, and a lot of our strategic thinking has been outsourced to the Americans. So when we are kind of going separate paths now in a multipolar world, there's not much political imagination to think of something different. And I think this is our huge curse at the moment. There's just full thinking and looking back, trying to recreate in the 90s or something along this line. So I think this is what makes states irrational. And if you want to see a lot of the problems we have today, I think irrationality is a key part of it. So that's kind of the core of neoclassical realism, which is the contesting the assumption that states behave rationally.
Right. Thank you for that answer. And what research are you currently working on? I'm just curious.
Well, I'm trying to finish a book now on the crisis of liberalism. And I do some comparisons to what happened in the 19th century and what's currently happening now. Because there's a common idea that liberalism comes, whether it's economic or societal, political, that it comes with many advantages. But it's also the assumption that the liberalism as, call it an ideology of liberation of the individual from the group, that there's in its victory, it kills itself. For example, Alexis de Tocqueville, 200 years ago, he made this point that liberalism, that the individual carved out rights for itself outside of the group, that this was a very positive thing. But he also noticed that it doesn't stop. The longer it's free, the freer it will be. But what does freedom mean? It means eventually it will free itself from its from the group, from the society. So less connected with your own society, disconnect from culture, disconnected from your neighbors, family, your traditions. And at the end, in his words, he wrote something along the line that finally the human being will be completely, in its complete freedom, it will be alone in its heart. So it will be, and this is not human nature. Human beings are a social animal. Anyways, my point is you disintegrate a lot of society, and you see a similar problem in the economic sphere. That is, if you look at John Stuart Mill, he pointed out that, during economic or globalization, as it was in the early 19th century, you often have democracy and liberalism going hand in hand, because people will vote for the liberal, and the liberal will contest the more conservative societal structure. But once you go into problems, that is after globalization, what do people want? Do they still vote for economic liberalism? And no, they start to retreat into the group again. They want protection for reproducing traditional values, culture. And now you have the democracy not supporting liberalism anymore. So you have a conflict there, and I think you see this today as well. So anyways, I just realized you asked me what I'm working on, and I went on for a bit
too
long.
That's very interesting, of course.
Side by side, bracing ourselves, cause it's a rocky ride. Governments come and go, they rise and fall. It's we, the people, who should own the ball. Our determination is so strong. Tyrants tremble when we sing this song. Cause in our thousands, in our millions, we are all Palestinians.
Palestinians.
We are waiting for the dawn of light. As voices echo through the night, from the river to the sea, Palestine will soon be free.
Listen to the prayer of the people tonight, calling
savior to show them light. Rise up, it's time for you and I to shine, chanting free, free Palestine. Let's all rise to the occasion, ending Zionist occupation. Let's all ring the bells of freedom, chanting free, free Palestine. Oh, hear the cries beneath the stars. There's no peace when there's no justice. Say it, free, free Palestine. Viva, viva Palestina. Hurra, hurra, Palestine. Zindabad, Palestine. Free, free Palestine. Viva, viva Palestina. Hurra, hurra, Palestine. Zindabad, Palestine. Zindabad, Palestine. 'Cause we are waiting for the dawn of light as voices echo through the night. From the river to the sea, Palestine will soon be free. We are waiting for the dawn of light as voices echo.
Good day to all of our listeners from around the world. This is Iran Radio broadcasting from Tehran. I'm your presenter for the next hour. Let's listen about Islam. The word Islam literally means peace and submission, meaning peace with humanity and submission to the edict of Allah. There are two concepts here: duty owed to God and rights owed to fellow human beings, regardless of race, religion, or color. Muslims are duty bound to do good to others and sacrifice their own interests for the welfare of other people. There are many attributes of Allah mentioned in Islam. The two most common attributes used in the Holy Quran are the glorious and the merciful. According to Islam, Allah is ready to forgive and pardon people rather than being vengeful and quick to punish. The Islamic Declaration of Faith is simple and states, "There is none worthy of worship except Allah. Muhammad is the messenger of Allah." In fact, when someone becomes a Muslim, there is no elaborate ritual other than the acceptance of this belief and the recitation of this Declaration of Faith. It's the core in belief of all Muslims and is often written inside mosques as well as displayed as fine calligraphic art in the homes of Muslims. Thank you for joining us, and we are so glad to be with you in this part of Iran Radio. We start off this hour's programs with Israel Watch. The program critically analyzes Zionist media reports about current events and issues in the West Asia region. They will be followed by Minbar. You can listen to speeches on many different subjects by very well-known Islamic scholars and orators. And we round up this hour's programs with Unscripted. The program provides analysis and commentary on some important and sensitive issues of the day, with emphasis on the West Asia region. Stay with us for the next hour. We'll be right back.
welcomed Israeli media focused on the Israeli aggression against Doha, the failure of the assassination attempt against the Hamas leadership in Qatar, the course of the war on the Gaza Strip and the occupation of the city, and the project of annexing the occupied West Bank to the occupation entity. It also focused on Tel Aviv's rejection of a visit that French President Macron intends to carry out to the entity, and on the wave of outrage in global and especially American public opinion due to the war crimes committed by the occupation in the Gaza Strip. These topics will be the focus of discussion with Dr. Mohammed Sweden, academic and writer in international affairs, joining us here in the studio. Hello and welcome, Dr. Mohammed.
Thank you.
The Israeli aggression against Doha was the subject of commentary by analysts in Hebrew media, who viewed the failed attempt to assassinate Hamas leaders in Qatar as significant. Dr. Mohammed, what are the reasons that pushed Netanyahu to take the decision to attack Qatar in order to assassinate Hamas leaders?
First of all, it's important for people to know that Netanyahu did